Good morning. So, have you ever heard someone say that I'm religious, or I'm not religious, I'm spiritual? Now, depending on the context, there are different ways that I'll handle this. If it's a 19-year-old barista at Starbucks, and they're also ready to tell me about this brand new book they read, The Communist Manifesto, and how it's never been tried, then I realize the language just might be something they've picked up that's trendy. But if it's somebody who is a few years behind them, I often recognize that this type of language, when someone says that I'm spiritual but I'm not religious, it comes out of some type of hurt, usually at the hands of hypocrisy in the church. If we take some time, if we listen to their story, what I generally find out, what I generally hear, is that at one point or another, they had faith in Christians, they had faith in the church, and it may have been a spiritual leader, it may have been a parent or a grandparent who espoused the things of faith, but put a heavy burden on them that they could not bear and disappointed them by not living up to that high calling. And this morning, we're going to talk about hypocrisy, and we're going to talk about how on the way to the cross, Jesus confronted hypocrisy. And we're going to do all of this in the light of all of those weeks that we looked at what it means to be made in the image of God, and that everyone we encounter, whether or not that image is brightly restored in them, or if it's covered up by the mud and mire of this world, that everyone we encounter is also made in the imago Dei, or the image of God. Hypocrisy is a tough one, though. I'm going to tell you, if you don't have your toes stepped on a little bit this Sunday in this message, then you're probably not listening, because my toes have been stepped on a whole lot preparing the message. It's not easy to talk about hypocrisy because, on some level, if we are Christians, we are all hypocrites. All of us fall short, and we all have an ideal that we try to strive for that we don't live up to. None of us are perfect. But the type of hypocrisy that Jesus gets really frustrated with, that he confronts in the Pharisees, goes a little bit deeper than I'm striving and failing. It deals with a sickness that can infect the church and infect us as Christians that may be rightly disgusting to that cousin, that friend, that coworker who said to you, "Oh, I want to be spiritual, but I can have nothing to do with organized religion again because of this." Those hurts are real. And I believe that we can overcome them, that we as Christians can even learn to avoid them when we follow the words of Jesus, we follow the warnings of Jesus in Luke chapter 11. So we're going to begin Luke chapter 11. I'm going to begin reading in verse 37, but I think some context is important here. In verse 37, Jesus begins to deal with the Pharisees specifically. But before that, we see this whole encounter begins because Jesus casts out a demon. And as he does so, a crowd begins to form, and they are very interested in seeing what Jesus does. The demon makes the man mute, and as Jesus casts out this demon, the religious leaders don't know what to do because they don't know what to make of Jesus. They don't like what he's teaching. They have a comfortable position. We've talked about this before, but under Herod, the religious leaders, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes and the priests, they got to eat from the king's table. They got good food. They had security, much in a way they hadn't before. They lived under the Pax Romana, or the Roman peace that had come in. And while the regular folks in Israel, and Judea were frustrated with what was happening, were hungry for the promise of God to be fulfilled. Many of those who were in these positions of authority and power were quite comfortable with their position. And they didn't know what to do with Jesus because he's teaching things that are radical. He's teaching things that will make Herod and later Rome angry. He's teaching things that undermine the traditions that they have put into place for themselves that they had become very comfortable with. And as Jesus casts out this demon and the crowd is in awe and it's growing by the minute as what happens, the Pharisees begin to say to one another and loudly to the crowd, they said, well, it must be by the power of Beelzebub. It must be the devil's power that gives him power over the other demons. It's where we get such a beautiful, and it's not just in Luke, but Matthew shares a parallel story, another look at the same incident. It's where we get the famous quote that a house divided against itself cannot stand. Jesus is giving that as a rebuke to this idea that somehow the devil would cast out his own demons. But the crowd continues, and there's excitement. And Jesus begins to teach and he shares some warnings. And at the end of this, when Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. And so he went in and he reclined at the table. But the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. Then the Lord said to him, now then, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But now, as for what is inside you, be generous to the poor, and everything will be clean for you. So the first thing I want us to look at is the idea of being clean on the outside, but corrupt on the inside. And this is what Jesus is getting at when he shares this parable, this mini parable of the cup. Jesus confronts the Pharisees for focusing on outward cleanliness while neglecting inner purity. And again, the verse, now then, you Pharisees, clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. A few things that I think we have to understand from the passage that we had read coming into this point. The first one is that the idea of washing here was not a biblical command, not in the way the Pharisees did it. Now, Jesus, and really God the Father, when he gave the law to the Jewish people, he gave them rules on food and eating and cleansing, and there were things that were unclean. If you touch the dead, for instance, and we're going to get into that in the later passage here, you were ceremonially unclean. And there are reasons for that. If you touch the blood of an animal, you were unclean, and you had to go through a cleaning ritual. But as we think about what we know from a modern standpoint today, why do you think it was that God would make someone unclean after they touched a dead person? Could a dead person carry disease? Especially in that day and age. Why blood? How many of you like your chicken medium rare? Anybody? Maybe your steak, but definitely not your chicken. Because of salmonella. And if you touch the blood of an animal, there can be disease, there can be sickness. It's not that God has these weird quirks about food and cleanliness. It's that he loves his people and he doesn't want them to die of preventable disease and illness. So he gives them these ritual cleaning things. But the Jewish people, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Levites, they had taken things steps further. And they said, well, if we're out in a crowd of dirty people, we might accidentally touch someone who touched a dead person, Or worse yet, a woman on her menstrual cycle. And then if we touch a dirty person, or what if a dirty person touched a person who touched a person and then I touched them? Ooh. Then maybe I would be unclean and I wouldn't even know it. So they started to put all of these practices into place, these extra cleaning traditions and rituals, to where, I mean, the word used here in the Greek is actually that of the same root we use for baptism. That the idea is they would wash themselves from head to toe before they ate and do this very overtly outward cleansing so that they could show off to one another how spiritual they were. And Jesus walks past them, flagellating themselves and soaking themselves with water to make themselves clean in a way that God had not commanded. See, they elevated their own tradition to be like law. And Jesus walks right past all of that, and he immediately reclines and begins to eat. Oh, but Jesus, you were around all of those dirty people. And you skipped this and you began to eat. And as the Pharisees saw this, the wording is actually stronger than we get in our English translations. They were disgusted that Jesus would do such an unholy thing in their eyes. How could he come in as our guest and not even cleanse with the rest of us? But Jesus understood that not only was there tradition about outward appearance, about looking holy to each other, it was also a replacement for the inward things. I'm so thankful that I live under a tradition of grace. I've met and had friends that were Muslim, or other religious traditions where there was not the tradition of grace that we have. And when it come to understanding whether or not they were right with God, they literally had no idea. Have I done enough right things? Have I checked enough boxes? Is my scale far enough down here? Have I done more good than I have bad? And it's exhausting. I've even met some Christians that had a weird understanding. I would call it a hyper-Calvinist look. I mean, every time there was an altar call, they were receiving Christ anew again because they didn't know where they stood. They didn't understand the idea of being saved by grace. And under that, when you don't have that idea, you begin to replace obedience to God with things that you can easily measure and check off. See, if I'm honest, and I go out and have a day in the city, have I been obedient to God in every prompt the Spirit has given me? Did I pray for all the people that God called me to interrupt my day and pray for? Have I sacrificed in every way that God's called me to sacrifice? That's hard to know. It's hard to know. And if we're trying to dot every I and cross every T, there are so many intangible things when it comes to truly walking in the faith and being obedient that it's much easier to forget about that stuff. Have I truly given justice to the poor? Have I acted in mercy and love to those dirty people in the crowd? But what if I could replace that with all I have to do is give 10% of my mint and dill and sage? Well, that's not that hard. It may be sacrificial, but I can take it and I can count it and I can account for it and I can be meticulous. Well, what if I didn't have to do any of that mercy, love, and justice stuff? I just had to carefully cleanse myself in a long ritual before I eat. Well, I can do that. And I can know that I did that every single time. Well, I don't have to obey God sacrificially in my finances. as long as I show up to church on Sunday, I don't have to lead my family as long as I come to Bible study. I don't have to... You could fill in the blank. See, this is the root and the heart of legalism, of the Pharisee, in that we create these custom things that we know we can do, that we know we can track. And don't get me wrong, in the business world, I've been taught that any goal worth having is one that you can keep track of and know that you accomplished. But in the spiritual world, it's not that simple. There are times that I can be partially obedient and yet still disobedient, and God will deal with me with love and grace, but also with conviction. The walk with God is far more of a relationship than it is a checklist. We'll never be able to perfectly satisfy it. And that's why we all have to come to the cross of Christ together. See, we're all made in the image of God, and neither of us is all that much lower or all that much higher than the other. We try and make these distinctions. Oh, but they're so spiritual and I'm not. And at the end of the day, from where God stands, we're so close. It's like judging ourselves against a professional basketball player about how high we can jump, when the standard is, can you jump to the moon? We're so far off that we all have to come and approach the cross of Christ. And here, these Pharisees, they have created new rules and they have added to the rules. And Jesus confronts them and he says, you're so focused on cleaning the outside of the cup, but the inside is filthy. If you were to come to my house and I was to offer you a drink, a glass of water, and there was a bug on the outside of your cup, well, let's assume that it's like 3 inches or more down from the lip of the cup, you might not be too bothered by that. It's a fly that just kind of landed there and hung out. Not the hugest deal. But if that fly was on the inside of your cup, you had one kind of swimming in the water, and another one in the ice cube. And unfortunately, like, this is happening way more than I would like at restaurants, where you're like, there's actually a bug in your ice. Like, that's a bigger problem than any of us are willing to talk about right now. Next one, no ice. You'd say something. You'd be respectful and loving, I hope, unless you were one of my kids, and then you'd have strong words for me. But you would not drink that water because the inside of the cup matters more than the outside of the cup. The outside of the cup could be tarnished and dinged up as long as the inside's clean. For the Pharisees, the opposite was true. They were so concerned with how everyone else saw them. And that's even indicative in this invitation that Jesus was given. The Pharisees, they wanted to confront Jesus, but they were terrified to do it in public because every time they did, and this was frequent, there would be a large crowd and the crowds would be getting excited about Jesus and they would be growing and growing because of the powerful and miraculous things that Jesus would do. And the Pharisees would be like, but Jesus... And he would answer so beautifully. The Pharisees would be embarrassed and the crowds would go along with him. And so they developed a strategy, like, if we're going to confront Jesus, we better do it privately. Because he's way smarter than us in public. And at the end of the day, I really believe that many of these Pharisees, and we're going to get into it more, they knew exactly who Jesus was. They just weren't ready to receive him. Our scripture continues in verse 42. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogue and the respectful greetings in the marketplace. Woe to you, because you are like unmarked graves, which people walk over without knowing it. Other translations say you're like whitewashed tombs, full of dead bones on the inside, but pretty and white on the outside. One of the experts of the law answered him, "Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also." Which makes me laugh, because it's not us also. I mean, he's insulting them. Jesus replied, "And you experts in the law, woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them." So we look at heavy burdens and hollow religion. The next thing that Jesus got to is he confronted the hypocrisy in the religious leaders. The religious leaders, they obsessed over legal details, many they created, and neglect justice and love. Woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them. What does Jesus mean here? Again, I think he's referring to all of these extra things that were added. And we have to be careful. It's very dangerous for us to add extra burdens and extra things to the law of God. I can think of another place where this happened, and it's going all the way back to the beginning of our story. Does anybody remember how Eve added some extra burdens to God's command about the garden and the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Anybody want to shout it out? When the serpent was addressing Eve, Eve didn't say that God's command was that she shouldn't eat it. That's what God's command was, you have everything else, just do not eat this. Eve recites to the serpent, and God said that we must not even touch it or we will die. God said nothing about touching the fruit. She's minimizing the grace and the latitude that she's been given and maximizing the rigidity of God. And when we do this, we create a burden that's hard for us and hard for others. In the church today, I struggle as I see, and oftentimes it's in the word biblical. We like to say, well, this is biblical. This is the biblical way to do it. And sometimes I think that what we should be saying or what we really mean is not that it's biblical, but that it's biblically compatible. But we take things that extra step and we say, I can find some vague scriptures that go around this. One of them is in the world of dating. And I'm not talking about the idea of living together or premarital sex. God is very clear on all of that. But when I was a young man, I had other young or older men in the faith, pastors, that would tell me this is biblical courtship and this is the way that Christian relationships start and happen. And it wasn't bad advice. But I struggle if I take that exact same advice and I try and apply it and give it to my son today, so many years later, if all of those practical principles that align to the culture and the time that we were in, that are not biblical, they were just practical, they really mean the same thing today. And there's a growing sentiment about young men who are leaving the church because the church is kind of beating them up and asking them to be something that God may not be asking them to be. To fit a certain cultural picture or image of what does it mean to be strong and masculine in 2025. When these men are up against dating apps where The reality is that unless they look a certain way or make a certain amount of money or even are a certain height, women just swipe past them. I'm not saying I have the solution for all of that, but I think we have to be careful that we don't make extra things, quote unquote, biblical. I think it's okay to say this is a biblically compatible way to do it. I think Dave Ramsey and his financial advice is a good one. I think it's good to be debt-free. But I'm not sure that you can say it's biblical and tell somebody they can never use a credit card. Because that's Dave Ramsey's bent. It's not necessarily exactly God's. So we have to be careful. And we have to be humble. Because the religious teachers at the time, what they were doing is they were putting law after law after law, and many of these were ceremonial things, and they weren't practically feasible for anyone else. If you were a Pharisee, or if you were a Sadducee, or a Levite, your entire career was getting to be, quote-unquote, holy. You didn't have a farm to tend to. You didn't have to build your house. You didn't have to go gather. In fact, everyone else gathered the food that was the burnt offering and the grain offering that fed you. And extra food came in from Herod's table to keep you in his good graces. So at all of this time, you could take an hour before you ate to cleanse your whole body from head to toe and feel real good about yourself. But no one else that you were speaking to could. So by putting that out there and saying, this is what it means to be holy, you have to do it exactly this way. Those who were out watching them, there was no way they could live up to that burden. And they buckled underneath it and said, oh, I guess I'm just a bad person. And those identities, they get sticky. The religious leaders, they obsessed over all of these legal details, many of which they themselves came up with. And they created a burden for others they couldn't bear. But what's interesting is Jesus, especially when it comes to this idea of tithing the mint and all these little herbs, he doesn't say don't do it. He says do it by not neglecting the other. And here's the beautiful thing about following Jesus, because again, he says his yoke is easy and his burden is light. When we follow Jesus, when we truly are welled up with gratitude for what he's done for us, it's not difficult to put the tithe in the box. It's an act of joy. It's an outpouring of what God's already doing on the inside. It's super difficult to fake spiritual things on the outside and hope that they come inward. But when they start off on the inside of us, when it's the core of who we are and we're changed and we're not living with guilt and shame, but with grace and hope, all of a sudden, when God calls us to interrupt our day, when God calls us to give sacrificially, when God calls us to speak the words of encouragement or even hard words to another brother or sister to restore them, we will do it with joy. We won't neglect the outward things because the inward will demand it within us. But it's got to be inside first before it can be on the outside. Verse 47, woe to you because you build tombs for the prophets, and it was your ancestors who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your ancestors did. They killed the prophets and you build their tombs. Because of this, God in his wisdom said, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and others they will persecute. Therefore, this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world. From the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who was killed between the altar and the sanctuary. It's an interesting picture there. He was killed in the holy area. He was killed in the tabernacle or the temple. Yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible for all of it. Woe to you, experts in the law, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering. When Jesus went outside, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. Resisting the truth and rejecting the prophets. The Pharisees knew the truth but kept it from the people. Jesus said, "You have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering." Jesus does a lot in this last passage here. He's talking about how they have failed to live up to the promise that they knew, that they had studied. And we talked about this before with why didn't the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the religious leaders, these are the guys that were doing the sacrifice, that knew about the guilt offering and the grain offering and the Day of Atonement and all of these, the sacrificial system. It was so in depth. They knew of all of it. How in the world did they not see their own need? They also studied all of the prophets and the scriptures, and they built these beautiful tombs to them. They built these beautiful monuments, and they told their stories, and they knew the promises of Isaiah. They knew that all of the scriptures were this building story to the Messiah who would come, and they were waiting for him, and there is no reason or doubt that they should have that Jesus is this guy. They just don't like Jesus. And they hold this key to knowledge because many of the others, those everyday mom and pop farmers and agricultural families, they didn't have the ability to read the scriptures. They didn't know every single one of the promises. The job of the religious leaders was to share those promises with the people and to help them say, "This is the Messiah." They had one job. And because they didn't like Jesus, they held the key and they hindered others from entering. In this way, these religious leaders were not, and don't hear what I'm not saying, but they were not terribly unlike the demon that began the story. The demon that made the man mute and kept him from coming into the kingdom. Jesus had to cast out the demon and the man was able to enter in. Demons, they're fallen angels. They weren't created to be evil. And Jesus made it clear that even the demons know who Jesus is. They knew exactly who Jesus is because he was preeminent in creation. They had once sung his praises. They had once served at his table, but they had fallen away because they didn't like what God was doing. And now in the same way, these Pharisees who thought they were so smart, they weren't going to beat Jesus in public. So now let's have this conversation with them privately. And Jesus is saying things to them privately that I'm not sure he would have said to the crowd. So it sort of backfired on them because they got the deep truth. They got called on account by Jesus. He didn't mince words with them. He told them exactly what it was, that they were not only themselves not using the keys of knowledge and salvation that they had, but that they were keeping others from the kingdom. That they were heaping burdens on others, keeping them from the kingdom. And as we come together today, we have to ask where we are. Because in any room of people that we might encounter, there's going to be some who are literally failing and falling under a heavy religious burden. Others have heaped upon them. And then there are those of us who have been in the kingdom for a long time, and we have to ask the question, are you keeping others from Jesus by loading them up with a heavy religious burden? We got back from San Francisco, really late the other night. So if I'm a little jet-lagged, I am a little jet-lagged. So sorry if my enthusiasm is not where it always is. But while we were in San Francisco, it's a post-religious place. There's not a lot of churches in San Francisco. But I was amazed. There's all these signs, and you see similar ones around here, that, again, I'm not trying to insult anybody, but the signs pretty much say, I support the current thing. It's all the culture war pieces about gender and sexuality, and they're saying, we love everybody. And that's fine if you love everybody and you're welcoming to everybody, but there was this weird contrast as we were downtown, and there's lots and lots of closed storefronts right around all the fancy shops. We were down there because we wanted to take the cable car, the historic cable car, up the hill, and it's a big hill. And we went out to eat. And while we're eating there, the restaurant had portions that were massive. And it wasn't uncommon. They cut your sandwich in half for half of that sandwich to be in the box and placed in the trash can. And there were homeless people everywhere. And unfortunately, it hadn't rained in a long time, and there were rivers of wet everywhere that didn't smell so nice. And we're eating, we're finishing our meal, and one of these homeless men who is ragged and hungry comes in and begins to dig and pull a sandwich, untouched half sandwich, out of the trash can. And the shopkeeper comes and almost starts to beat him up, just yelling at him, it's disgusting, get out of my trash can. And I get that no one wants anyone digging in your trash. But it's this weird picture of we love everybody, but don't you dare eat even what I consider trash because you're hungry. So it's easy for me to judge others that way. And later we're walking down by Alamo Square and the kids see this kind of cool building and they say, Dad, what's a convalescent home? And I shared a little bit about its place that you would recover, and I knew some of the history, but then I went and I Googled that convalescent home, and I went from pointing fingers at others to beginning to point them back at myself and my people, because this convalescent home was created like so many others in San Francisco in the 80s during the AIDS epidemic. Because most of the churches, just like we have Lutheran and it used to be a religious, many of the churches had built hospitals, and these hospitals had a religious backing, and unfortunately, for so many reasons in the confusion, the church didn't do a very good job in the AIDS epidemic. There were a lot of preachers that got on the television and radio airwaves and said, this is God's judgment against the gays, and he's killing them on purpose. And they rejoiced in the suffering. Others weren't so bold, but sat on boards of hospitals and said, we can't let those unclean people in here. What might happen? Other people might not come. In Indiana, we're very well aware of the Blair White story, the boy who wasn't allowed to go to school because he got AIDS from a transfusion, and everyone was terrified, and we didn't understand, and I understand it was a confusing time, not unlike COVID. And even Fauci was in charge of both of them. But we as the church had an opportunity to go beyond the legalistic stuff and share the keys to the kingdom to those who were literally dying. And instead, the religious community said, no, you're not welcome here. And again, these things were just kind of on my heart and mind because I literally walked by it. So where are you today? Are you struggling because the burden is just too heavy and you can't keep all of these rules and regulations and you don't think you're capable of following Jesus? Jesus said his yoke is easy and his burden is light. He's not there to heap a bunch on you. He's there to walk beside you, one step at a time, transforming you into his image and likeness. Or maybe today, you're one to say, oh man, I think I've been heaping extra burdens on others that have kept them from coming into the kingdom of God. And the beauty is, we have the ability to repent and say, God, I don't want to do that anymore. Instead, let me be your hands and your feet. Let me get dirty like you got dirty. Because Jesus said, his yoke is easy and his burden is light. Would you pray with me?